I'm Matthew McCabe. Welcome to Miracle Voices. Each episode, we will be delving into stories of forgiveness, healing, and transformation that have come about from integrating the principles of the book, A Course in Miracles. If you want to learn more about A Course in Miracles, visit www.acim.org. If you'd like to visit the Miracle Voices site, please go to www.miraclevoices.org. If you feel inspired to make a love offering, please visit us at miraclevoices.org/donate. All donations go to support the work of the Foundation for Inner Peace, the publisher of A Course in Miracles. Now here's your program. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another edition of Miracle Voices. This is your co-host, Matt McCabe, and I'm here with my co-host, Tam Morgan. Tam, how you doing today?
Good. I think it's Good Friday, actually. As soon as I said good, I thought of that.
Yeah, It is. Happy Good Friday.
Yeah, happy good. Do you say that?
We do now.
Okay.
You just did, didn't you?
That's right. Happy Good Friday and the happy dream.
That's right.
There we go.
And you heard another voice there. That's our guest today, John Mundy. John, welcome to Miracle Voices.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you. Appreciate being with you, Tam. Good to see you.
Enjoy.
Well, John, where are you sitting in the world right now?
I'm sitting about an hour north of New York City, not too far from the Hudson River, in Orange County, New York.
Nice. And this question, it goes pretty deep for you, but maybe you could tell us how A Course in Miracles came into your life and when.
Okay, well, it's a little story. First of all, I met Helen and Bill in April of 1973, so that would be 51 years ago, at a conference which was sponsored by an organization called Spiritual Frontiers Fellowship, where Hugh Lynn Casey was the keynote speaker. And I was leading a workshop because my first book had just come out, was called Learning to Die. And I did a workshop. And Helen and Bill came to my workshop. And after the workshop ended, I was introduced to the two of them. And they told me that Helen had written an inspirational book. I don't remember whether they said Course in Miracles or not. I don't think so. In any event, you know, Helen was a short little woman with frizzy hair and big glasses. And I just had my first book out. I'm 29 at the time. And I look at Helen and I think, isn't that sweet? The little old lady wrote an inspirational book. It's probably got some nice poems in it and things like that, prayers. Talk about projection, right? So little did I know we were talking about The Course in Miracles itself and, you know, and the 669 pages in the workbook and all that. So that was in 1973. I'm sure that they had a meeting with Hugh Lynn, although I was not a part of that, of course, because this was just our first meeting. The next year, 1974, I wrote a letter which got published in the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology, when I expressed interest in being in contact with anybody who was working in the fields of psychotherapy and spirituality, because I was doing a dissertation on that at the time. Bill saw my letter, and he told Helen that he thought it was a call for her to complete the writing of the psychotherapy pamphlet. So Helen had started the psychotherapy pamphlet, but she had never finished it. And she agreed that it was a call for her to do that. So she called me in April 1975, and that's 49 years ago, and said she had something for me. And she didn't explain what it was. She just said that there was something that they wanted to give me. So I agreed to go meet her and Bill and Ken and Father Benedict Rochelle and Ken's little tiny studio apartment on East 17th Street in New York City, which is, by the way, it's just directly across the street from Helen. Ken deliberately got that apartment across the street from Helen so it'd make it easy for the two of them to work together. I had no idea what she was talking about, but I went to the meeting, and Helen sat on Ken's daybed, And I think Ken sat next to her. And then there was Bill and Benedict Rochelle. And Helen just explained to me, as best she could in a very short time, Rochelle was there just to see how they would present the course to a neophyte, what the course was about. And she gave me the psychotherapy pamphlet. And I remember walking home with her that night. Now, keep in mind, they were on East 17th Street, and I was living in General Theological Seminary on the west side between 19th and 20th. So it was just a crosstown walk, only 20 minutes or maybe 25 minutes. And at that point, we just decided that we would get together again, at least Ken and I would get together again, which we did about 2 weeks later. Ken came to my apartment. I had an office-apartment combination inside the General Theological Seminary. And we had our first like chat. We kind of really went over our life stories of how we had been growing spiritually and interests and all that sort of stuff. Ken really liked General Theological. Looks like Oxford. It's built the same kind of style format. It's an entire block in New York City. And Helen had also said that if I needed anything, you know, to call her, we would talk some more. Well, it just so happened I needed her very shortly thereafter. And what happened was that there was a lady I'd had a couple of dates with. Then I decided I didn't want to continue seeing her. And she got very, 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 very angry about that and started acting out. She would call me at 2 o'clock in the morning just to let the phone ring, just to wake me up. So I got so I had to take the phone off the hook before I would go to bed, and acting out in other difficult ways. She came to the seminary once when I wasn't there, and the guard at the door told her I wasn't in. She picked a cup of coffee up off of his desk and threw it in his face and ran out the door. But the worst thing was that she showed up outside of my apartment one day with, and I didn't know she was there, not my new lady that I was dating, actually somebody I dated for 10 years, was there. We came out. As we came out, she physically attacked the other lady. Now, nothing happened because I was able to restrain her. I threw her my keys to my date. She ran out of the building, went out and got in the car and locked the doors. So nothing physical happened. But it was a very disturbing situation. And I called Helen upset about what was going on. And Helen said, come see me. So I went to see Helen. This is the first of a few times of seeing Helen like this. I must say I went through 3 relationships during the 5 years that I knew Helen. I was sort of looking for my, not sort of, I was looking for my wife, and I hadn't found her yet. I didn't find her until I was 50 years old, but that's another story. So I went to see Helen in Ken's apartment. I never would see Helen in her own apartment. It was my understanding from Judy and Ken that was a bit disheveled. Louis, her husband, his Bible was the New York Times, and apparently he had stacks of them around and stuff like that, which Helen didn't like. And, but it was so close that she would just meet, we would meet there, and Ken would just not be around at the time. He had plenty of things to do. So I told Helen about what had happened, and, it wasn't there very, very long. And Helen was, by the way, very, very direct with me. It wasn't like a psychotherapy session where you go into your past and, you know, all this stuff that was going on. She would just tell me, all right, this is what you should do. Very kind in that regard. And I told her the story about this woman. And Helen, she did this more than once. She reached out. We were sitting kind of catty-corner to each other and tapped my knee. And she would tap my knee. And she said, this woman needs your help. All right. The next time she calls, you answer the phone and you talk to her. Well, that same night, she called. And I answered the phone at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And we talked and we talked and we talked until the light was coming in the window outside. So we talked till daylight. We worked it out. We are friends to this day. She called me last week. That, what, 49 years ago? It was just a matter of forgiveness. You know, she just needed me to just to be there and to be for her. I don't see her, but we call each other on our birthdays, that sort of thing. It's even possible I might see her at an event or something, but she was never a course student or anything like that, so don't see her very often. But the relationship was healed. I mean, literally, we had a nice chat last week. It was just absolutely remarkable what happened. Or I guess it wasn't remarkable. It was miraculous what happened. So that was the beginning. And I'll tell you about another time of going over to see Helen. And this was another case of romance. Except this time, I had fallen in love. But it was very irrational. By that I mean, the lady in particular, I had children, adolescent children. Her husband was still very, very much the father, even though they were separated. And an opportunity came up for her to professionally to go to another state. And the question was, would she go? Would she take this other occupation? And we went to see Helen in Ken's apartment. And again, it didn't last very long. We were only there for a little while. And Helen reached out and tapped my knee. And she said, she, I won't give her name, should go. And she said this interesting thing that she said, if it's really important, you can get together later. I might add that this particular person is still a friend to this day. Of course, that's a long time ago, but still, she's a friend to this day. And mostly it was relationship with Helen was on the phone. I would call her whenever I needed her. She would call me. She was very kind, but she knew that I was going through something. She would call me. I'll give you one more example of that. So I had always had this desire to have a place where I could have retreats, where people could come out and, you know, spend a weekend, go through a kind of therapeutic session thing, not just with me, but with different leaders. I enjoyed inviting different leaders. And in the meantime, I had started setting up lecture opportunities for Ken in New York City, in Westchester, where my new home was, and then also in Orange County, where a church that I would wind up serving was as well. And I found this place that was just wonderful. It was, oh gosh, 500 more than that feet off of the road, completely secluded. You couldn't see it from the road. Parking for 25 cars. It's called High Rock Spring. It was beautiful, 2.5 acres, right in Katona, New York. Easy walk to the train station. Just a lot of things that were great about it. And I put the money down on it. And then I was talking to Helen and Bill about what had happened, about the place. One of the first people I sponsored was Ken. And Helen says, this is not going to work out for you. And I go, what? You know, she says, I'm sorry, I don't think this is going to work. And I'm doing like, what are you, psychic or something? Oh, good Lord. So with the very first workshop I put together, I got a cease and desist order from the zoning board. So I couldn't do it. So then I went to the zoning board and they said, well, you can always apply for a variance. And if you get the variance, then you can do that kind of thing here. So, I applied for a variance. And, Helen was still really concerned about what was going on. And so there was a, this was in July, I guess it was 77. I bought the place in about a couple of months prior to that. And the zoning board, when I got there, the courtroom was filled with people, just filled. And it turned out that somebody in the neighborhood had got wind of what was going on, and they got a petition against me. And I had to send out a notice to people within about a 2-block notice about what my intentions were, so everybody knew about it. And it was a very hot night in July, and the air conditioning was broke in this courtroom. And they couldn't get the windows open because they were actually painted shut. So we were 11th on the docket, and the case didn't come up till the 11 o'clock at night. A lot of people had left, but the few that were still there, they were just, blood was boiling, was so hot. And so it was pretty quick. Actually, it was very interesting for what happened, because the vote was 5-4 and 5 against. But the head of the zoning board was the one who made the final decision, and he said no. So it was 6-5. So I lost. So Helen called the next morning, very concerned about what, and I told Helen about what had happened. And she says, well, it's okay. Things will, and it was interesting. Bill intervened at one point. Bill intervened during a little earlier part of this. And Bill told Helen to leave me alone. He said, this is going to work out. Now, Bill's playing the role of a sidekick, right? Well, I never was able to use it in the highly, the commercial sense that I intended, but it was so secluded. And I was able to do quite a number of workshops and seminars there. No advertising at all in the community. One of the mistakes I made was putting a sign out by the road. So I had to take that sign down. And I was allowed a sign of 1 foot by 1 foot, which all it did was just said High Rock Spring on it. So I started doing sponsoring Ken there, usually twice a year. Usually I would do it on like Memorial Day weekend and Labor Day weekend. So that wouldn't be unusual that a lot of cars are coming and going up the driveway. We could be having a big party, which was kind of, we did make it into sort of a party, you know, lunch and all that. But I had a really, some fantastic people, Stanislav Grof, I won't run through the list of people, Joan. And so I did that for, it turned out that I was there for 10 years. And what the way it worked out was, I sold the place for $225,000 more than I had paid for it. So that way, in that sense, it was very profitable. But I won't go ahead with the rest of that story. I moved across the river near where the church is, near where I am now, and got another place. But I won't go into that part of the story because it doesn't involve Helen or Bill. But the main thing was that we became really good friends. And now let's bring in Tam's mother. So Judy and I had been friends since around 67, 68, along in there, 69. Because we were both members of the American Society for Psychical Research. In fact, at one point, I was dating Vera Feldman, who was the secretary to the president of the American Society for Psychical Research, one of the best relationships ever had in my life. We're still friends. Well, I don't know that we are. I think maybe she's passed. I haven't heard from her now for quite a while. So we had these same interests, and, you know, with her Parasensory Foundation and with Spiritual Frontiers Fellowship and with the American Society for Psychical Research, we kept overlapping a lot. Tam can tell you what I'm about to tell you with as much facility as I can, but Judy was always having people over to watch Uri Geller, Ben Spoons, or seeing the latest in Carlian photography, or, you know, whatever the latest psychic that was in town, that was a well-known psychic or something like that. And that was always a lot of fun. And it was also where we would all get together, never at Ken's place or certainly not at Helen's place. But usually the gatherings would be at Judy's and at the Beresford and 81st and Central Park West. Tam can tell you, how long did you live there, Tam? It was a beautiful place.
We lived there for, I'm just trying to, I'm so bad at years, but I was 12 to about 9 years.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a great place to get together. And so that's one of the greatest regrets of my life, although I didn't know it was a regret at the time, was that I guess it was in 90. Well, not long. The course was published on June 22nd, 1976. Tam, I'm sure you were there. Mm-hmm. It was in your apartment.
Yep.
And Judy and Helen pulled me aside, and we went into a side room. And Helen gave me my first copy of The Course in Miracles. And said, I think you're supposed to teach this. Or it might have been Judy that did that. I'm not sure if it was Judy that handed it to me or Helen, but they were just the two of them. And one of them said, I think you're supposed to teach this. Now, I'm working on a doctorate at the time. I'm teaching full-time at the New School University. I'm running a church in Brooklyn. And I'm trying to have relationships. How in the world would I teach this? You know, and just like everybody else, it took me a while before I really began to understand the course. But not long after that experience, and just, did I say July? It was in June of 76.
Yeah, you said June.
Yeah, it was in June 20. I said June. Okay. In July, and I won't go into this, I'm going to do another interview on the second part here with somebody else, this next week. I had a near-death experience, a profound one, and don't mind saying it happened with the use of very heavy-duty psychotropics in the jungles in Chiapas in southern Mexico, under the supervision of a Mexican psychiatrist, Dr. Salvador Roquette, and his kind of entourage. Well, all of a sudden, I saw what the course was talking about. I mean, I saw it. And so when I came back, then I started diving into it, because then it made sense. You've got to jump beyond the form. You got to jump into the concept in a deeper level to begin to see. I mean, there's no world. Come on, what are you talking about? You know, that's ridiculous. You know, look around you. Well, I left this world for a while, so that was another dimension. Was actually what happened, and all those kind of things that go with that. So that is a very long answer to your question about how we met and continue to work together. I did not see Helen during the last year or so of her life. She kind of let herself go, according to Judy and Ken. But that's kind of the story right there, just as far as the original meeting and all that concern. And from then on, it was mostly, then I was working with Ken a lot. Well,
I have a couple of questions.
Yeah.
What a surprise. Okay. First of all, back when Father Benedict Rochelle was there, and when you first, you know, met really Bill, Ken, and Helen,
right.
And she was described, and he was watching, Father Ben was watching Helen describe the course to you to see how they describe this to a neophyte. How did she? What did she say to you about the course?
Oh, God, Tam, I really don't remember. Keep in mind, that was 49 years ago.
Yeah, no, I will keep that in mind.
it was, I'm sure she just did as simply as she could for someone like. Now, I might add that I was very interested in mysticism. I wrote a book on mysticism. What is mysticism? That wasn't until later, but I was teaching classes on mysticism and esoteric and mystical philosophies at the New School University. At that time, I started doing that there in 69, and I did it up through the fall of 78. So we knew a lot about our common transpersonal kinds of interests and that sort of thing.
And my question, okay, so you don't remember exactly how she described it, but she, it seems from my perspective here, she didn't describe it in a compelling enough way to make you go, tell me more. How do I do this? How do I get this from you? How do I share this with you? You just let that be.
It was actually, I was so busy at the time teaching and doing doctoral studies that I remember when I got back to my office apartment, I remember laying it on my desk and saying, I'll get to that later.
Well, did she, but way earlier than when you met my mother and was handed to you, you weren't given a copy at that time. She just discussed it with you. Is that right?
What she gave me was the manuscript of the psychotherapy pamphlet.
She gave, okay.
That's all I had at that time.
And what did you think of that?
Well, that's the same thing. I didn't even get around to reading that right away because there was so many other things that was going on. And actually, it was not until I started working more closely with Ken that I started getting deeper into actually studying, and doing the workbook lessons and all that sort of stuff in the course.
Right. Okay.
That wasn't, of course, until, June 22nd, 1976. And then thereafter, and I started to mention something I regretted. And what I regretted was that Judy invited me to be a part of they are going through the workbook of the course together on a daily basis. And I was so busy, I had to say no. So, but boy, oh boy, would that have been wonderful to have gone through that with them. Well, it still would have. I know what you're thinking.
No, I'm laughing. I'm joking because there was a lot of interpersonal dynamics at that time. But yes, of course. How could it not have been? I was just peripherally.
Yeah, I know.
At a different age, so.
Judy would from time to time kind of let me on a little bit about the interpersonal dynamics. I'm sure you saw much more of that in detail than I did.
Yeah, they were for me amusing. So. So, and the other thing too, and was that the last time you saw Father Ben?
I'm sorry, just missed the word.
I'm sorry, saw Father Ben, Father Benedict Grisham.
Oh, no, it wasn't, not at all. As a matter of fact, in 1979, I got a job working for the Foundation for Religion and Mental Health in Briarcliff, New York, putting together Saturday seminars for them. And I did one with Tom Ostora, who started transpersonal psychology. I was largely responsible for it. Others were as well, of course. I did one with Ken. I did one with Benedict Rochelle.
Ah.
Had him come speak at the Foundation for Religion and Mental Health as well.
Oh. And did he share all his perceptions about the course? Because he was one of the first people who knew about it.
Yeah, I know. No. At that time, he was talking more just about the generality of the connections between psychotherapy and spirituality.
I was just interested. Then another couple of questions. Sorry, Matt. I will hand
no
it
problem.
Over. Promise. The other couple of questions before I forget them. I was really interested just in how your wording put it, because I usually go there. That Helen helped you with the first woman who was attacking your next woman. And how that woman needed for you to see her, and that the miracle seemed to happen and shifted when you saw her, when the irony is that your whole path with her was that you didn't want to see her. And so it couldn't see her, in a romantic way, and that she just wanted to get through so that she felt seen, so that there was forgiveness. And Helen could feel that it was a brother asking.
That's it. That's it. Yeah, that's all it was. I never was with her ever, of course, again.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen her at a couple of events and things like that. She came to my 60th birthday party. No, my 45th birthday party, I think it was. Things like that.
Yeah, and it was, this is our podcast is about forgiveness stories, and that definitely, you know, is was a, a
oh, it's a great forgiveness because
forgiveness.
I mean, it really worked. You know, it was just, you know, I have a 3 grandchildren that we take care of part of the time, and the youngest one, who's 4 years old, kind of did a temper tantrum last weekend. And it was kind of the same thing in that I realized when he was doing his temper tantrum, what he was really doing was saying, I need to be loved.
Yeah.
You know, and so I went and I sat with him on the couch and just sat there and started rubbing him back a little bit. And then he crawled over and laid his head on my lap and, you know, and then it was like, it was all over, you know, nothing happened. You know, it just, you know, give me a little bit of love here, will you?
Right. Even if it's irrational and you are, give me more at this moment.
So, that's it. You know, it's just, this is what you need. I'll happy to share some time with you.
And then the last, I hope, question that I have for this moment is, when the next woman came and she had this draw to go elsewhere or a professional job elsewhere, and Helen told her to do that, did she give any reason? Was there any, or what did this, did you both go on a leap of faith because Helen said that? I'm sure there
was. It was really illogical. She was older than I was. She had children. I mean, I was in no shape to take on children at that point. The father, as I said, was very much the father, even though they were separated and all that sort of stuff. But a psychic thing happened around that too. When we left Helen that time, this is, Helen lived right near Greenwich Village, or practically in Greenwich Village. And we started walking, this lady and I, we started walking down through Greenwich Village looking for a place for dinner. And we passed one of these psychics in the window, this woman, you know, like the psychic.
Right, right.
Come in, you know, and all that. And this woman says, let's go in and get a reading. And I said, no, I'm not, that this wasn't really interesting. She said, come on, let's go get a reading. I said, well, if you want to do it, we'll do it. So we went in and the woman starts doing a reading. And all of a sudden she stops and she says to me, will you come with me? And with a beaded curtain, you went through a beaded curtain into another room. And she said, this woman who's with you, she should go. Helen just said the same thing a half hour earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's just what I was questioning. Was Helen giving some sound psychological advice, or was Helen seeing something that you respected enough to listen to?
No, it was just, there wasn't time, as I said, for analysis or anything. It was just, this is what you should do.
Got it.
Right? And she was always right.
Mm-hmm.
Always right. So.
Okay, Matt, I'm done.
Okay.
No rush. Well, John, you mentioned that you had this NDE and that you said, I saw what the course was talking about. Can you describe a little more detail what you mean by that?
Oh, well, for one thing, that there's no world. Now, there is a world in a sense, but it's a very mundane sense. You know, that's what our immediate experience is right now. So you shouldn't say that what's right in front of us isn't real. I mean, ultimately, that's a very important word. Ultimately, it's not real because it's a dream. It's a part of a dream, which is really hard to understand. But the Course says that a lot. This whole experience is a dream. There's a problem in describing it insofar as we have to begin to move outside of space-time. And you really can't talk about something. The Course draws a distinction, as you know, between perception and knowledge. Well, perception is something we can talk about because our senses are telling us what's out there. And so we identify things. But it's very difficult to talk about something which is more cognitive, where you take a kind of jump out of it, and then you're seeing it from another perspective. And you see, a better way to say that, this is a dream. The world is a dream. And that doesn't make a lot of sense when you're looking at mountains and stuff like that, but it is. And look at the near-death experiences people have. I don't know about you, but I love watching all these, you get hundreds and hundreds of them on YouTube now, more and more of them all the time. And they're different, but they have interesting overlaps. And usually, often the people are describing something that's still kind of physical, if you will. And that was true for me too, but it was more psychological in terms of what was. I had, for the lack of a better description, insight flashlight, insight flashlight, insight flashlight, insight flashlight, insight flashlight, insight flashlight, insight. And I kept seeing all these. It was like in a mathematical formula process, except that doesn't make sense. I'm not a mathematician in any way at all. But I turned into a. The best physical description is that, first of all, it was horrifying. It was just horrific. Actually, it bears a lot of similarity to a Kundalini. I think it was a Kundalini experience because it fits pretty good into that category. By that, I mean the ego was literally ripped out of me. I mean, it was horrific that John Mundy died. I don't know how to say it. I lost my body. I lost the identity. I lost space time. But some of these things I remember, they would flash, like the farm I grew up, that flashed in front of me and then disappeared. And my father flashed in front of me and disappeared. And just, and maybe this is all going on really, really, really quickly. You know, there was just like stages of growth and excitement. But there was nothing left of this body, this name. I can remember the experience, otherwise I couldn't talk about it. And I know this is all sounds pretty strange. There's a detailed description of it. It's in a book I wrote called Eternal Life and A Course in Miracles, where I talk about this whole thing. It's also on tape. It's you can get it online. You have to get that book called Eternal Life and A Course in Miracles. And there's a three-chapter description. The first chapter is the prequel to the experience. I mean, there's a whole prequel to it, our getting into the jungles and what that was like and why we went into the jungles to have this experience and what Salvador was doing. And the night before this happened, by the way, we observed the killing and the butchering of a cow, which is something that the Indians, they did that on purpose. They wanted us to see this, a cow which they were then going to eat, of course. Again, that's it. All those kind of details are in that description. I don't think we've got time for that now. Well, anyhow, it exists in writing and it exists in audio. If people want to get it as best as I can, to put it into 10 minutes is...
it's a lesson.
Yeah, it's a lesson. Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. But after that, I was able to understand the course much better. I'm like, you're not a body. Okay, I got that. I got it. You know, for more people, you tell them they're not a body, and they go,
yeah. It takes them a lifetime to get to that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're not a body. There's no world. There's no time. I mean, those are all absurd, but they're not absurd. That's true.
But that does bring us to your selected forgiveness story.
Yeah. It always works like that. It's always pretty simple, really. As the course says, this is a very simple course. Forgiveness is very simple. All you got to do is let go of your own insanity. You think somebody did something to you? Well, who's the you that you think they did it to? Well, an ego? Well, you're not an ego. Only egos could be hurt, you know.
I know there's no order in difficulty of miracles, and maybe there isn't truly a biggest forgiveness story, but is there something that really, I mean, you've had such a long time of practicing the course and moving through things? Was there anything that was a particular obstacle?
The biggest forgiveness thing is not about anyone or anything. It's about forgiving myself.
Okay, bring it on.
For a lot of silly, stupid choices that I made in life. And if I'd have known better, you know, if I'd have thought through the thing, I allowed for distractions of all sorts to get in the way. Allowed material things to get in the way, allowed sex to get in the way, earthly things like that, blocks to the awareness of love's presence, forgiving myself for having picked up some of the blocks that I picked up along the way. And you always pick up a block because of some selfish reason, you know, it's the selfish part of the self that we let go of.
So for you, I don't want to speak for you. I'm asking. Your forgiveness is more processed throughout all of the little things that you have to forgive yourself for. And do you feel like you do that regularly? That's a regular practice for you.
Well, of course. And the thing is that I don't make as big of mistakes as I used to make. Let's put it that way. Because we do learn, you know. I mean, I hope I learn. I'm 80 years old now and been at this for quite a long time. Doesn't mean I couldn't make another mistake. But it helps you to focus and to get down to clear about what the center is and where you need to be and how you don't need to be wandering off into all kinds of distractions when the goal is just to keep your eye on straight as the way and narrow as the gate that leads into life. You know, few there are that go therein. So that's a constant practice for all of us. But this, as you keep saying, it's a learning. This is what the course is for, right?
Yeah. When people would ask Jerry Jampolsky in his 90s, you know, how are you? And he'd say, still learning. That's why.
Yeah, sure.
Still here? Still learning.
Still learning. I more normally now say wonderful or something like that and really mean it because I think things are personally pretty much going the way they should go.
And you've had some health issues. And how is the practice through that? Like, we've had so many people come on and say, you know, I felt so guilty for having this health issue. And what kind of, you know, course student was I? And they went through the process and realized, of course, that one had nothing to do with the other in a certain kind of way. Or there were people who went, oh, I realized this and everything cleared up. What was your experience in that way?
You're right. It's been quite a number. I had a quadruple bypass in 1998. Mehmet Oz did that, by the way. It's strange, the people that get a hold of your heart. but he did, and that was okay. You know, every time it happens, there's a beautiful opportunity in being able to look at death and to step aside for a while, to step out of the world, if you will, for a while. I had cancer in 2001, 2002. I had a resection, took out 18 inches of my intestines and found that the cancer had spread to other parts of my body. And I went through 30 weeks of chemo. But that was it was a cleansing kind of thing. It was a release too, even that. And then I had encephalitis. That was the strangest thing of all, encephalitis. Because I went to a coma and I stayed in a coma for quite a long time, for over a week. But that was a cleansing as well. See, every time you step away from the world, you get to, well, I'll tell you about more recently, just 2 years ago, I had I had COVID. I had a real bad case of COVID. I was in the hospital for 24 days and locked in a room, and nobody could come or go out of there except for, you know, somebody who's got uniform on of some sort, you know, all plastic shields and all that stuff. And I thought I was going to die. I mean, that got really, really down to looking like I was going to die. And somewhere about, oh, 2/3, 3/4 of the way through that, one night when I thought I'm going to die now, I remember rolling over and hearing the voice. And all the voice said was, go or stay. Either way, you will not lose your mind. And that's true in terms of the course, that you can, that's the one thing you cannot lose. You will not lose your mind. You'll still have a mind. I decided at that point to stay, very simply because my wife has some health concerns, and I knew she needed me, and my grandchildren and my daughter, they all needed me. And so I came back for them. That's the only reason I came back. I didn't come back for any other reason. But that's, I'm really glad I did. So I see these issues as purification processes.
Thank you.
I'm probably healthier right now than I've been almost ever.
It's a beautiful insight. The alarm goes off when I hear that, because remember that those were some of Bill's last words. I'm healthier now than I've been forever, and I've forgiven everyone. And he walked outside and had a heart attack the next morning.
Yeah, and I remember your mom's description of the experience very well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was quite extraordinary. But thank you.
Mm-hmm. John, Tam, one of the things that threw me in deeper into the course was Judy. Because so I'm told about it in April, and Judy gets it in like Memorial Day weekend of May of that same year.
May 29th.
And she just took fire with it. And when I saw how she had taken fire with the course, I thought, well, this really is something. Look how excited Judy is about this. So that helped me to get into it more deeply as well, because if she's going for it, I probably should be going for it. You know,
and that's what friendship's all about.
That's it. Yeah. True.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did.
No, me too.
Yeah. And here, all these years later, you're having a podcast with her daughter. Yeah. You never thought she'd be into it.
Yeah, that's fun. Your mother was wonderful. Always, always, always so wonderful to me. And so generous and loving. And we got along so well. Whit, too, by the way. By the way, is Bob still with us?
He's about to be 99.
Wow.
And he's very much, very much with us.
I remember I called Bob on his 90th, round about his 90th birthday, and said I'd like to do a feature article for him in Miracles Magazine. And he said, oh, no, that doesn't interest me.
Right.
For those who don't know, we're talking about Bob Scutch.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Matt, are you ego storming it?
Yes. Yes, John, I know you've worked with so many students and you've seen them kind of understand A Course in Miracles. When they get into an ego storm or ego backlash and they're really struggling, is there any tips that you give that helps them, that they say, hey, oh, John, that was a really helpful tip or suggestion on how to get centered back in, you know, in my purpose?
Well, the main thing would just be try to help them to understand that it is an ego attack and doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the external world, that it's an internal process of letting go. That's all forgiveness is. We're just letting go of this whole idea that there's something real here that I'm trying to make real that's not real. I mean, in the world of form, it may look very real. This guy may really have hurt me and run off or whatever it is. I mean, those things do happen. And so it takes time, but once you can realize that it's the ego that's in pain and you're not an ego, then you got a good shot of being able to step aside from it. But that takes some work, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And John, a question just for fun here. What is your favorite comfort food?
My favorite comfort food. Well, gosh. I tell you what I'm eating right now.
Sure.
Are you in need of comfort right now? What's here on my desk is a delicious apple.
What a symbol.
I hadn't thought of that too, but it's a delicious.
There you go.
Wonderful. It's a honey crisp apple.
Oh yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
But they've made hybrid apples so good that they're like the crunch and the flavor. It's like, my God,
yeah, I know.
Aftertaste, everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. They don't look. Yeah. Those are good ones. I like those too. Well, John, before we close, is there anywhere you want to point listeners so they can connect with you online?
Well, it's pretty simple, really. I publish a magazine called Miracles. I've been doing so since 1985. We're still going. Type in miraclesmagazine.org online, miraclesmagazine.org, or there's an organization I work with called the One Man Foundation, which was started by my friend Dave Fishman. We now work together. And either one of those, but Miracles Magazine will take you right to it. And you can get a sample copy of the magazine. I might add that we have extended beyond the course. The course is central. Every article I write is based on the course, and it's the lead article. But we also look at the course of love now and quite a number of other things as well.
Mm. Well, John, thanks so much for coming on Miracle Voices and sharing your miracle voice. We appreciate it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, nice meeting you.
Thanks so much for listening today. Please subscribe to Miracle Voices by hitting the subscribe button on your podcast app. If you are enjoying these conversations, please consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever podcast app you use. And lastly, please visit us at miraclevoices.org and join our newsletter so we can stay connected. Until the next podcast, I want to leave you with my favorite course quote, "When you want only love, you will see nothing else."